Welcome to another disturbing episode of American Hauntings, the podcast hosted and produced by Cody Beck and written and performed by Troy Taylor. That's me. There isn't much that's amusing about this one. Every episode has taken you to the dark side of Hollywood, the movie capital of the world, a place that's supposed to be all about palm trees, swimming pools, and movie stars, but you're not going to find any of that this time around. This is a look at one of the most evil crimes in the history of Los Angeles, and one that left a haunting in its wake. Each episode of this scandalous season, which started with episode 70 and, well, will end at some point, reveals another sordid Hollywood tale of crime, corruption, murder, and, of course, ghosts. But remember, the episodes in this season may not be suitable for all listeners, especially this one, so listen at your own risk. Hang up your telephone, lock the doors, and make sure you know where your children are as you tune into this new episode of American Hauntings. It was Saturday afternoon in the suburban town of Inglewood, just a few miles from Los Angeles. Three little girls, Jeanette Stevens, age 8, Melba Everett, age 9, and Madeline Everett, age 7, left home with sandwiches to have a picnic in the park, just as thousands of other ordinary children were likely doing in thousands of other ordinary towns across the country. But this Saturday would turn out to be anything but ordinary. Hours passed and the afternoon began to turn to evening, but the girls had not come home. Their mothers grew uneasy. Mrs. Stevens sent her 7-year-old son Garth to the park to look for the girls, but the park was empty. The girls were gone. An hour later, the parents called the police. By midnight, a community-wide search was on and the disappearance of the three lost girls was broadcast on the Los Angeles Police Network. By the next morning, the alarm was out all over the state. On Monday afternoon, 6 Boy Scouts who were part of a volunteer army that was scouring the countryside for the girls stumbled into a deep gully about 2 miles from the road in Baldwin Hills. Deep in the weeds, lying face down in the dirt, were the half-naked bodies of the three missing girls. They had been raped and they had been strangled. As the horrible news of the murder spread through the Los Angeles area, the police began rounding up suspected sex criminals and piecing together possible clues. Little did they know that the killer they were seeking was standing just a few feet away. Wearing a WPA badge and serving as a volunteer policeman at the scene of the discovery of the bodies was a slim 32-year-old man who would have known the three little girls from his work as a crossing guard in front of their elementary school. At the discovery of the bodies, he asked the men in the crowd not to smoke, quote, out of respect for the dead. When he went home that night, his 24-year-old wife, Isabel, helped him to add the day's newspaper clippings about the tragedy to a scrapbook he'd started when the girls were first reported missing. He'd known them, after all. He saw them every day at school. He told Isabel that he couldn't get their little faces out of his mind. By week's end, angry crowds were protesting in front of the Inglewood City Hall, threatening to lynch suspect after suspect the police were bringing in for questioning. Isabel's husband was right there with them, raising his voice louder than all the rest, until he was the suspect to which the police turned. He begged them to take him to Los Angeles where he could give his confession. The people in Inglewood would tear me to pieces, he said. When Isabel heard the news that her husband had confessed to the terrible murders, she wept. He couldn't have done this terrible thing, she sobbed. We both loved children. We lost 2 babies of our own. But he had done that terrible thing. He had lured the girls into the woods, murdered them, and then raped them one by one. Then, in a fit of remorse, he had prayed over their broken bodies and asked God to forgive him. And maybe God did, but the people of California did not. And neither did those three little girls. According to the killer himself, their spirits literally haunted him into the grave. On On Saturday, June 26, 1937, there were plenty of people enjoying the day at Englewood Sentinella Park. The park was then described as a 60-acre beauty spot where city dwellers can dip in a pool, picnic, play tennis, and horseshoes. It was the perfect spot for three neighborhood girls to have a picnic on a sunny afternoon. The Everett sisters, Melba and Madeline, were there with their best friend and next-door neighbor, Jeanette Stevens. They'd arrived around 10 a.m. with a blanket, some toys, sandwiches, and a bottle of milk. They spent about 2 hours playing with their friends, eating their lunch, and at some point, speaking to a man someone later described as being dark-haired, unshaven, and in his late 20s. He was about 5 feet 9 inches tall, weighed around 140 pounds, and was wearing a tan work shirt and dungaree trousers. Around noon, Mrs. Crapcuff, who newspapers called the matron of the pool but was really just a park attendant who'd been roped into lifeguard duty, saw the girls running from the wading pool toward the picnic area. She asked them where they were going, and Jeanette shouted back, "Rabbit hunting!" She sped past with her two friends. "Don't go too far," the pool matron called back and gave them a wave. Except for their killer, she was the last person to see the three girls alive. When the girls failed to return that night, their parents first sent Garth Stevens to see if he could find his sister and her friends. When he came back without them, though, they frantically made their own search of the park. Finding no sign of their daughters, they contacted Chief Oscar E. Campbell of the Englewood Police. A description of the missing girls was sent out to every police station in the Los Angeles area, noting their ages, weights, hair color, and the clothing they'd been wearing when they left for the park. Englewood's entire police department, as well as the fire department, began a search. They were joined by officers and deputy sheriffs from all over the Los Angeles and the surrounding areas, more than 50 members of the Santa Monica Mounted Police, hundreds of American Legion volunteers, scores of private citizens, and nearly 200 Boy Scouts. They were in automobiles, on horseback, and on foot. And they spent all day Sunday combing the countryside, including the ravines and gulches along the banks of the Sentinella Wash, a rugged section of the park. Although newspaper headlines suggested that the girls had been kidnapped for ransom, Chief Campbell was skeptical of this theory. For one thing, the families were not well off. Merle Everett, the father of Madeline and Melba, was a department store clerk, and Jeanette's father, Floyd, was a clerk at a grocery store. Also, by Sunday evening, neither family had received a demand for money. "It's definitely not a ransom kidnapping," Chief Campbell finally announced to reporters late on Sunday afternoon. When asked if he thought the girls might be in the hands of a degenerate, he gave a grim reply. "I'm beginning to fear the results of the search. I'm afraid to say whether we'll find them alive." Even after night had fallen, volunteers continued the search using torches and flashlights, roaming the Baldwin and Palos Verdes Hills, their voices echoing in the trees as they called the names of the three little girls over and over again. Local women served coffee and sandwiches to the men who walked the woods throughout the long night. By Monday, the searchers, now more than 500 men, were joined by a pair of airplanes that flew over the rough rolling hills to see into places the volunteers on the ground couldn't reach. Newspapers called it the most intensive manhunt in Southern California in more than a decade. The reporters were referring to a case from 12 years before when two sisters, Mary and Nina Martin, vanished mysteriously while walking just a few blocks to their grandmother's house. The skeletal remains of the two girls were discovered 5 months later in a nearby ravine, and an autopsy determined they'd been slain by a, quote, sex-mad killer. It would not take nearly as long to find the bodies of Jeanette, Madeline, and Melba, but that discovery, as feared by Chief Campbell, would be just as terrible. It was a Boy Scout named Frank Portuna who found them, and it would be a long time before that 16-year-old would sleep well again. Around 2 p.m. on Monday afternoon, June 28th, Frank and five fellow members of the Englewood Troop 2030 were carefully making their way down the rough slope of a hidden gully in the Baldwin Hills. Just as Frank reached the bottom, he looked up and choked at the ghastly sight. Lying face down in the dirt were the bodies of three little girls. They were each half naked with their skirts pushed up around their waists. Each of them had a piece of clothesline twisted tightly around her neck. Strangely, all three were barefoot. Their shoes had been removed and then carefully placed in a precise line not far from the bodies. Leaving his companions to watch over the scene, Frank raced back to town and informed the police about what they'd found. One reporter wrote, quote, "The town was filled with horror. Business came to a virtual standstill. Huge crowds formed in front of the police station. Slowly but surely, the mob spirit rose. The mothers of the little victims collapsed while their husbands tried to stand up to the news." Well, the news that the bodies of the missing girls had been discovered spread rapidly in newspapers and on the radio. The people of Southern California were horrified by the reports, and the newspapers further sensationalized the case by calling the murdered girls the Babes of Inglewood, a heartbreaking moniker that sold even more papers than they would have already sold before. In Sacramento, Governor Frank F. Merriman called on police officers throughout the state to devote themselves to capturing the killer, the perpetrator of what he called the most fiendish crime in the whole criminal annals of Los Angeles County. Now, that's a bit of an overstatement, but it did authorize hundreds of lawmen to join in the investigation. During interviews with other children who often played at Centinela Park, including Olive Everett, the 11-year-old sister of Madeline and Melba, detectives learned of a possible suspect. He was known as Eddie the Sailor, and he had approached several girls in the park, entertained them with rope tricks, and offered to take them to his car to show them some rabbits. He was described as a Mexican-looking man in his late 20s, about 5 feet 9 inches tall, weighing between 150 and 165 pounds, with dark brown hair and mustache badly needing to shave, and a tattoo on his lower right arm. He was wearing a tan work shirt and dungarees. And yes, this is an almost identical description of the man last seen talking to the girls on the day they vanished. Well, over the next several days, dozens of men who roughly matched the description were hauled into the Inglewood police station for questioning. Mobs of outraged men and women loitered outside the station trying to get a look at the men who were brought inside. Now, there were several likely suspects, all of them bad, but all of them also had solid alibis, and they were questioned and released. Now, one suspect was a man named Albert Dyer, age 32, a crossing guard at the victim's elementary school, who, according to witness Mike Herta, knew Madeline, Melba, and Jeanette and was always acting queer around little girls. However, Dyer had volunteered to help in the search and had recently been seen in the crowd outside the police station. He'd been told to pipe down after he'd shouted out threats to several of the men who were brought inside for questioning. He seemed an unlikely killer, but the detectives, well, they were being thorough. When they went to his house to speak to him, Dyer's wife told investigators that her husband was at home with her on the afternoon of the murders, working in the yard and gardening. They scratched him off their list. As with any sensational case, the investigation became bogged down with telephone calls, false reports, and dead-end leads. In Bel Air, a butler reported that several hours after the girls were strangled, a man wearing blood-stained clothing and resembling the killer had appeared at the back door of the home where he worked and desperately tried to sell his car. The man begged him to take it, saying that he desperately needed to get rid of it. He even offered to sell it for $10, but he was turned away. A shadowy figure named Otto was briefly sought by the police after Carol Sims, age 20, reported that the stranger had followed her from a San Pedro cafe, forced her into his car, and drove her to a cabin in the Palos Verdes Hills. He kept her captive there and repeatedly raped her before she could escape. Well, on June 30th, the search turned toward Glendale and northbound highways when a motorist named Andy Stankiewicz telephoned police to say he'd seen a young man fitting the description of the killer, even down to the tattoo on his right arm. And the man had picked up two young boys at North Figueroa Street and San Fernando Road. It turned out to be nothing, and there were many more, and each of them led nowhere. By July 1st, after pursuing scores of leads, checking out pointless tips, and questioning more than 100 men, the police were no closer to finding the killer of the three girls. After chasing leads and interviewing suspects for days, investigators went in a different direction and contacted Dr. Joseph Paul DeRiver, the sole police psychiatrist for the Los Angeles Police Department. While Dr. DeRiver's greatest achievements were still a decade in the future, when he became intimately involved in the infamous Black Dahlia case, he'd already earned a reputation for himself with the LAPD, screening the nuts, crackpots, and other deluded of individuals who stepped forward with a confession or a claim relating to a murder. He was also able to offer insight into both crimes and criminals, which the Inglewood detectives badly needed. Dr. DeRiver visited the crime scene and viewed the bodies in the morgue. He noted that the girls had been laid face down, their dresses pulled up, and their shoes placed side by side in a row. After considering all the evidence, he described the type of person the police should be seeking. A sadistic pedophile in his 20s who was meticulous in his appearance, religious, and remorseful. He might have a past record for annoying children or loitering where they played. The crime had been planned and the killer had known how to approach the girls without scaring them because they trusted him and he'd used that to his advantage. Well, as it turned out, Dr. DeRiver's description of the killer was eerily accurate. Even though he was in his early 30s and hadn't been previously arrested for bothering children, the profile was almost a perfect match for the perpetrator when he was finally arrested. Dr. DeRiver's profile of the killer in the Inglewood case was only the second case in history at that time of a criminal profile being used to try and catch a killer. The first was in the landmark profile of serial killer Jack the Ripper, which was drawn up by two London physicians in the 1880s. Their profile had failed. Dr. DeRiver's had not. Although perhaps it's not fair to say that the police caught the killer of the three murdered girls, it would be a lot more accurate to say that he caught himself. On the evening of July 2nd, District Attorney Burren Fitz, Captain William Penfraise of the Sheriff's Homicide Detail, and Chief Investigator Eugene Williams, along with a dozen or so other officers and detectives, were conferring in the second floor police headquarters at Inglewood City Hall when a black-haired man with darting eyes and a frantic look on his face burst into the room. The detectives knew him, but had never seen him look so out of sorts. It was Albert Dyer, the school crossing guard who had briefly been considered a suspect in the murders. His wife had provided him with an alibi, and detectives moved on to other leads. Dyer had been a slightly irritating fixture in the investigation. He'd volunteered during the initial search and had made an effort to shake hands with every police officer he encountered, thanking them for their efforts being made to solve the crime. He'd been in the crowd outside with the other irate citizens yelling, "Lynch the son of a bitch!" when he'd seen suspects being brought into the station for questioning. He'd even been photographed among the men carrying the small bodies of the victims into the morgue. Most of the officers in the room probably had one thought go through their mind when they saw him. What did he want now? But this time was different. "What do you fellas want with me?" he shouted at them. "Why do you suspect me?" Well, the group fell silent. Detective Williams finally spoke. "Why don't you take a seat over there? We'll be with you shortly." Albert stalked across the room and sat down hard in a chair. He fussed and shifted back and forth, getting more agitated as Detective Williams allowed nearly 20 minutes to pass. Finally, the detective walked slowly over to where Albert was fidgeting in his chair. "Now, what's this all about?" he asked. Albert cried out, "I want to know why you suspect me. I haven't done anything. I can prove where I was. Ask my wife." By this time, Dyer knew that the investigators had been to his home and had spoken to his wife. What he didn't know was that his wife's statement had cleared him of suspicion. Until now. Williams was a veteran detective. He knew something was seriously wrong with the situation. He knew how guilty men behaved, and no matter what Dyer's wife had told the officers, her husband was acting very strangely. But with a suspect as highly strung as this one, he knew the best way to handle him. "Why, we're not looking for you," Williams assured him. "You're getting all worked up over nothing. Why don't you go home and get a good night's sleep?" Although still visibly upset, Albert nodded and tried to give the detective a relieved smile. It faltered on his face and then disappeared. He got up from the chair and headed for the door. Detective Williams patted him on the back. "Just remember," he told him soothingly, "you're okay as far as we're concerned." Well, the moment Albert left the room, Williams turned to a pair of officers, Detectives R.O. Williams and G.E. Chandler, members of the LAPD burglary detail who'd been assigned to help with the Babes of Inglewood investigation, and he ordered them to follow the distraught crossing guard. "Don't let him out of your sight," he ordered them as they hurried out after Albert Dyer. They followed him all day on Saturday, July 3rd, and reported back that Dyer had acted strangely all day. Something was definitely going on with him, and it gave the two detectives an edgy feeling. Williams listened to their report and instructed them to go out and get Dyer early the next morning, even if he was still in bed. "Take him to the crime scene," he told them, "and see how he behaves." Well, the two detectives returned to the station around 2 p.m. the following day, more convinced than ever that Albert Dyer was their man. They just couldn't prove it yet. They told Williams that when they got to the crime scene in the Baldwin Hills Ravine, he started trembling and crying. He didn't say anything, but he was clearly upset. When Detective Chandler outright accused him of being involved in the slayings, Dyer denied it. He admitted that he knew the three little girls and added that he'd developed a, quote, keen liking for them. Well, the school faculty, it turned out, had warned him twice about his behavior with the children. Albert admitted that he also called himself Eddie the Sailor because he liked to entertain kids at the park with fancy knot tying and other rope tricks. Well, Detective Williams had heard enough. Arrest him, he told the officers. Later that same afternoon, Albert was picked up at his home and taken to the Inglewood Station, which was surrounded by as many as 1,000 enraged men and women. He begged to be taken somewhere else. The mob would kill him, he said. And hey, I've done nothing wrong. The police smuggled the suspect to the district attorney's office in the LA Hall of Justice building. At the same time, his wife Isabel was also picked up and brought to the city for questioning. For the next 2 hours, Albert continued to protest his innocence. I like them very much, he said of the three slain girls. On that Saturday, I met them in the park about 10:30 and showed them some rope tricks. Around 12:30, I left them, though, and went home and spent all afternoon hoeing in the garden. And then he added once again, you can ask my wife. In a separate room, detectives were doing just that. At first, Isabel stuck to her original story. Finally, about 7:30 that evening, she cracked. She'd been lying, she wept. Her husband had left home at 10 a.m. and returned for lunch around noon. He left immediately afterwards and didn't return until after dark. He told her he was very tired and he went straight to bed. When he was informed of his wife's statement, Albert broke down. Oh God, he cried out. I did it. I killed all three of them. I'm so sorry. Why? Why did you do it? One of the detectives asked. Sex. No other reason, he shook his head. Just sex. It took two lengthy interrogations by District Attorney Fitz, Detective Williams, and other officers, along with a team of psychiatrists brought in to evaluate his sanity, to get to the bottom of Albert Dyer's perversity and the atrocity that it drove him to commit. Although he'd enjoyed a seemingly satisfactory sex life with his wife of 2 years, Albert had become obsessed with the idea of sex with little girls. He became a crossing guard so he could even look at them. Even the smell of young girls drove him close to madness, he said. But Albert knew he would never have the chance to have sex with them unless he killed them. Being dead, he explained, they would not be able to resist me. About a month before the murders, the urge for a child had become irresistible, and he scouted out the ravine in the hills. A few weeks passed while he made his selection, finally choosing Janetta, Madeline, and Melba as his victims. On that fateful Saturday morning, he spotted the three of them at the park. They were sitting in the grass near the baseball diamond, and he approached them to show off his rope tricks. The girls were delighted. They knew Albert from school and believed they had nothing to fear from him. When he asked them if they wanted to go rabbit hunting, they leapt at the chance. Staying a short distance ahead of them so that if anyone saw him, they would not know he was with the children, Albert led the girls to the isolated ravine. After telling them that he could only take one of them in at a time to see the rabbits, he first led Madeline off into the bushes. The other two girls waited a short distance away. As soon as he had Madeline out of sight, Albert grabbed her and strangled her with one of the pieces of rope that he carried in his pocket. He returned to the other girls and explained that he left Madeline at a spot where she could, quote, catch the rabbits if they ran down the hill. Melba was next. She was the only one who struggled, Albert told the investigators. Please don't, she cried as he tightened the rope around her neck. But Albert paid no attention to her pleas. He killed her, and then he went back for Jeanette. Albert admitted that he became more excited with each murder. At last, once they were dead, he pulled off their underclothing and, quote, fulfilled his sexual desires on each child. When the horror was over, Albert had to face what he'd done. He was a monster. But he'd learned to live with it. According to his statement, he arranged the shoes neatly in a row because he wanted whoever found them to think the children had been orderly to the end. He knelt beside the girls and he prayed for God to save the souls of the children and, quote, save my soul and forgive me for what I have done. Albert claimed that he felt satisfied and fulfilled when he left the bodies behind in the ravine and that he had a good night's sleep, but Dr. DeRiver would have disputed this if he was still consulting on the case. Albert had left the bodies of the girls face down in the dirt so he would not have to look upon their faces. That way, they could not see his shame. Only a man under tremendous guilt would have come into the police station the way that he did and demand to know why the police suspected him. He brought the attention to himself. He wanted the police to obtain his confession. He was a monster. He tried to live with it, but he couldn't. There was nothing he knew that could save his soul. After his confession, Albert was taken to the Los Angeles County Jail. He was booked, given a shower, outfitted in regulation prison denim, and escorted to a solitary cell. As he walked down the corridor, he was yelled at and threatened by other inmates. There was no sympathy, even among rapists and murderers, for a child killer. Meanwhile, detectives were searching Albert's home and uncovered physical evidence linking him to the crime, including three lengths of blood-stained rope and the bone-handled pocket knife that he'd used to cut the lengths of line that he strangled each girl with. They also found the scrapbook that Albert had been making. It started on the days that the girls had disappeared and was filled with newspaper clippings about the search and the discovery of the bodies. He had been obsessed with the case for reasons now that seemed evident. Detectives came to believe that his behavior outside the station as a ringleader of the disorder whenever a new suspect was brought in for questioning was to divert suspicion from himself. But it's also possible he just couldn't help himself. By continually calling attention to himself, he wanted someone to notice him, someone who would ask questions and discover the horrific crime that he'd committed. Albert was arraigned on Tuesday, July 6th. As the indictments were read, he fainted in the courtroom. Deputies carried him unconscious back to his cell. Examined by psychiatrists for both the prosecution and the defense, he was found to be a sadistic degenerate, but legally sane. As he awaited trial, he paced his cell, read the Bible, and smoked an endless number of cigarettes, and was haunted by the dead. According to Dyer and witnesses among the guards and other inmates that he told, the ghosts of the three girls visited him in his cell. They spoke to him endlessly at night, he claimed, and refused to let him sleep. Was this just an attempt to resurrect the insanity defense? Was Albert Dyer truly insane, or was he really being harassed by spirits? Of course, we'll never know for sure, but Albert continued to claim that the ghosts of Jeanette, Madeline, and Melba haunted him, even after he was on death row and had no legal recourse that would save him from the hangman. Albert's three-week trial began on Friday, August 6th. Over 500 would-be spectators, mostly women, came hoping for seats in a courtroom that would not hold more than 150. A special contingent of deputies was assigned to maintain order. After a lengthy jury selection, the prosecution began its case on Friday, August 13th. The state summoned several dozen witnesses who identified Dyer as the man they'd see talking to the three girls on the day they disappeared. They also saw him leading them out of the park toward the Baldwin Hills. Albert's entire 48-page confession was read into the record, and gruesome morgue photographs of the slain children were shown to the jury. The jury began their deliberations on Tuesday, August 24th. 2 days later, seven men and five women found Albert Dyer guilty on all three accounts of first-degree murder, a verdict that carried a mandatory sentence of death. On his way out of the courtroom to be transported to San Quentin for his execution, Albert turned to his wife, Isabel, and spoke. "Well, I guess I'll see you in heaven," he said. Isabel must have thought that seemed unlikely. Albert spent his days on death row just as he had spent his days awaiting trial, smoking cigarettes, reading the Bible, and pacing his cell. He had little interest in prolonging his life. He didn't wait for word from the governor that his sentence had been commuted. Instead, he spent his days remembering what he had done, and he spent his nights trying to sleep. He tossed and turned, but the ghosts refused to let him close his eyes. They were angry, he told his jailers, and they hated him for what he'd done. God might forgive him for his sins, but his victims would not. They would literally haunt him to the very last moments of his life. On the morning of September 16th, 1938, after a last meal of ham, eggs, pancakes, and coffee, Albert Dyer was hanged. He was the second to last person to be executed on the gallows in California before the state began using the gas chamber. It was a fitting end for a killer who strangled three little girls with a rope. If only he could have been hanged two more times.
There's one thing that the American Hauntings podcast knows about. And that's mothers. We featured a lot of great mothers in a lot of our episodes. Pearl Curran, Julia Lemp, Sarah Moore, Marie Laveau, Jane Mansfield, Tamsin Donner, Delphine LaLaurie, Belle Gunness. Okay, maybe leave out those last two. But what I'm saying is that with Mother's Day coming soon, you need a truly special gift for your mom because, well, she's not Belle Gunness. So let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that literally turns your mom's life story into a book. So here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your mom a question in her email, the same way she sends you questions about your dating life or when you plan to give her grandkids. Anyway, these can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you want to ask. She replies by either typing in the answers or by recording her own voice. Then MyLifeInABook.com compiles all her responses into a keepsake book. And they can create an audiobook that uses her voice recordings, preserving her voice and her stories forever. As anyone who doesn't have their mom around anymore can tell you, having your mother's stories about growing up, being a kid, and overcoming life's challenges will be something that you and your kids will treasure. And let's be honest, your mom has given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a very cool way to share them. Honestly, I decided to try this out for myself and I sent it to my mom, and she's not exactly a whiz at computers, but she still found it really easy to use. My mom might have had a little more unusual childhood than a lot of mothers do, so I'm really glad to have this. And I think you'll be glad to give one to your mother too. So check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS for 10% off today.
Episodes.
Well, I know, but and it's a good episode.
I know.
It's a, you know, okay. Well, of course, we can make that into it. That'll be the funny part.
Yeah.
Is that we don't want to be funny.
We don't want to be funny. Yeah. All right. Ugh. Thanks for tuning into the American Hauntings Podcast, the show where we discuss history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the very, very dark side of American history. We are now in season 5 of the podcast, Haunted Hollywood. I'm your co-host, Cody Beck, and with me is my co-host, author, historian, crime buff, and the founder of American Hauntings, Troy Taylor.
Sorry. That's
yeah,
all I can
yeah,
say is
you
sorry.
You should apologize
there isn't,
for the monologue.
Yeah, there isn't anything that I can say other than sorry for pretty much everyone involved in this episode.
This is a bad one,
I know.
Man.
It's
probably the worst.
Yeah, it, actually, I, you know, for those of you listening, I tried to talk Cody into just like when we finished, when the monologue was over, just reading the end and just being done because I wasn't sure what we were going to say about this
what
one.
Do you say?
I'm not sure how much discussion there is to have. There are certainly no jokes to go along with this.
I literally texted
really
you and
aren't.
Said, I think
so,
for the first time, I don't have any
I
jokes.
I don't have any jokes. I know.
As
so
far, as far as, okay, so sort of, as far as fucked up stories that you talk about, well, we're going to get into a bunch of stuff, obviously, in upcoming events, listener reviews,
yeah, sure.
all the normal stuff. But
yeah.
as far as fucked up stories and terrible things, I know, for instance, like Lisa doesn't like any of the stuff with children and everything.
Right,
but,
right,
but
right.
you go into a lot of stuff. Where would this rate on like a scale from 1 to 10 on the weird, terrible things you've written about and talked about and all that?
It's pretty high.
You think?
Yeah, this episode and the next episode are...
Which I still don't know what that is.
Right, I know you don't, but the next episode too is also going to be awful.
Mm-hmm.
And these are pretty high on the list.
Yeah, I'm trying to just calibrate and see...
They're pretty... Well, the next one is worse, actually,
no
than this
shit.
One. But then we'll... I mean, none of them are good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always,
well,
I mean,
yeah.
that's the reason why we have ghost stories attached to this stuff.
People
but,
have to die.
Yeah, because people have died in usually horrific ways. But L.A. and Southern California just has a special place, you know, kind of like
sure.
New York does, of really, really horrific things.
Mm-hmm.
Not that, you know, there aren't things like that in other cities, too. But,
yeah.
you know, L.A. especially has become famous for... You know, how bad can it get? Well, you know,
did it happen in L.A.? Then it's bad. You know, right. I mean, that's just how it goes. So, yeah, this is an awful story, and it's really high on my list of awful stories. Mm-hmm. But I felt like that it was something worth including in this episode,
yeah.
You know, or in this season, I'm
well,
rather.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, in this season. So, yeah, anyway, well, let's talk about a couple of our housekeeping kind
yeah,
of things
yeah.
before we get too far into this episode. I wanted to plug that we just recently updated all of our websites with ghost hunts coming up through the summer. We also updated it with dinner and spirits events coming up for the rest of the summer. This month, we have an evening with the Lent family. We have an evening with the St. Louis Exorcism, which, of course, you know, heated up on, you know, after that Discovery Plus thing
yep.
aired a couple of weeks ago. And then we've got,
man.
Yeah, whatever. and then we've got another one of those coming up at the end of May. But then we've also got some new stuff too. In April, I've got a brand new one, which is Hell Hath No Fury, which is about women murderers and killers.
Hell yeah.
Something I only did for a small group during Dead of Winter. So this is kind of for everybody else. I've got the one about the like sinister demonic hauntings too coming up in
okay.
April. After that, I've got a bunch of new stuff. I'm going to do an evening with the Donner Party. We will not be serving human flesh.
So many jokes.
For
okay.
dinner.
Never
I know
mind.
There are. And we're going to be doing Edgar Allan Poe. Evening, a couple of different things that we've got coming up. So just check out the website. You can get to all of that stuff at AmericanHauntings.net. My new book is coming out in a couple of weeks, The Forlorn Hope, about speaking of the Donner Party.
Yep.
That is about the Donner Party. So I'm starting to feel like, you know, I worked on the Donner Party book through the winter, mm-hmm. through the really cold part of the winter. And now that we're getting into March, I kind of feel like, you know, spring is getting closer, so
Troy and I just talked about his coat.
I know.
For so long.
I know. We did. Well, we were talking today. I bought my first like parka that
it's
I've
a nice
owned.
Coat.
Yeah, I mean it is, and it's the first parka I've
you're
owned
mad
in
about
like
it.
25 years. That Lisa talked me into buying because she felt it was ridiculous. I mean, even when I was living in Chicago, I did not own a coat.
That's ridiculous.
I just own jackets. I like jackets. I just dress in layers, man. I mean, right now I've got like three layers
that,
on.
You know,
I mean, that's normal.
That is something.
And then, so just a coat is another layer, but she
sure.
talked me into this big giant parka. And
I
it is nice.
I was when I saw you in it. For
it's
the first
nice
time.
When it's really cold out, but I mean, to me, cold is like below 10.
Yeah.
You know, anything above that, it's not that cold.
Well, we were talking
and,
about how
yeah.
the coat worked so well. It worked itself out of a job because yeah, Troy's yeah. like, I don't need this. I'm
I
warm.
Know. Well, because I'm warm and then I think I don't need it. So then I take it off. But
conflicted.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, so I just keep, you know, spring is coming. You know, it's going to be coming soon. And they
so.
Keep saying we're going to have an above average. Of course, they said we were going to have above average February. Look how that turned out.
Yeah.
But they are saying an above average warm spring.
How do they?
You know, which I don't even know what that means.
Is it the Farmer's Almanac?
No,
what
no. This
do?
Was the Weather Channel.
Do?
But you know, really, I look out? At it and I think the Farmer's Almanac or a fucking groundhog.
Right.
This is how we forecast weather.
Right. That's what I was.
Although,
wondering.
Really. It's not that far off considering that
50-50
you
show.
Watch the Weather Channel and they say, oh, it's going to be this. And then you look outside and it's snowing
well,
and it's not supposed to be doing anything. So you're kind of like, what the hell just happened?
Well, we were just talking about how it's like, it's kind of presumptuous for them to say it's a 0% chance
right.
of this. It's like, you really
right.
want to take that gamble?
I know,
like,
right? Because they have no idea what they're talking about. So anyway, but what, just with these things in mind, we do have good things coming.
What out of all the new stuff you have coming up, whether it's like events or evenings with or books, or whatever, what's the thing you're most excited about that's a new thing?
Well, and you know, I am excited. I'm excited about the Donner Party book, but
yeah.
I'm also excited about doing a bunch of new dinner things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's one of those things that is hard in some ways because people want you to just keep doing the
Exorcist,
evening with the St. Louis Exorcism.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, I don't want to keep doing that because, A, you saturate the market in a way, but people still come. And then you don't know if people are going to come to the new ones, even as no matter how interesting they are.
Sure.
You don't know if people will come because they're like, oh, well, I don't really know that so well. Well, I know, but that's the reason
that's
to come.
The point,
so,
right?
Yeah. So, if you're a listener to the podcast and you live in the St. Louis area, please come. Yeah. When we do these new ones, please come because
I want to dress in character.
I know, but they're a lot of fun for me to do, and so I always like it when people will come and see something new,
like Edgar Allan Poe. That's,
yeah,
that's,
I mean, how do you go wrong? There's some good stories there.
Really,
there's a lot of good stuff. So. You know, I do have some good things coming, so hopefully, you know, people will come. And, you know, then we've got the conference at the end of July, so I'm excited about that, too. And actually, as of this recording, we've only got, like, 50 seats left.
Damn, all right.
I know. Oh, well, but, I mean, we are combining 2 years, but, you know, last year, we've actually got more people signed up this year than we had last year when we finally called it off at the end of April.
Eager to do something.
Yeah, I think so, too. Yeah. So... we've actually got a lot of people signed up already. So if you're thinking about coming to the conference, seriously, make your reservation because we're not going to have space. I mean, we have to cut it off at some point. And, so if you're thinking about coming, definitely check it out. AmericanHauntings.net. Just go. You can find all this stuff.
Yeah.
Anything we do is on that page.
Yeah, come hang out. So, tell me a ghost story.
Yeah, exactly.
Scott and I, I'm sure, will be shooting shit all day just recording ghost stories.
I'm sure.
Let's dive into some listener reviews here.
Sure.
So this first one is titled Absolutely Amazing Storytelling. It's from Mrs. Britt. It said, not only do you get the historical aspect of everything, but you also get to hear various bits and bobs of other stories that people share that they get to investigate. It's just amazing. And that was from Saturday. So thank you so much. And this last one is titled Love Listening to This. It's from Truckin' Mama. which I love. It says, I'm a truck driver and listen to this podcast while I'm driving. Funny thing is that I was just sent up to Pontoon Beach, Illinois for a weekend and went to Alton to look around while on my reset. It was amazing to be in the place where this podcast all started and to see some of the sights. Keep up the great work, guys.
Cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, Alton's nothing special if you're from here, but if you haven't seen
it,
you know,
it's cool
to see. And also, I talk shit, but like, I love this town
so
much. I want to move back here, and it makes me so upset
to
admit
that. Have
you
not had much luck with that?
So, okay, I'll put this out here right now. I was looking at an apartment that's above the old Lighthouse Sounds right by the Lincoln Square.
Sure.
That actually got swooped
up. I didn't even know
somebody.
They had an above.
Yeah, well, not it's not above there, but it's around the corner.
I know where it is.
It's kind of facing the river.
Yes.
I want an apartment in that area on Broadway.
Downtown Alton,
Broadway area. Preferably above something that's not a bar, if I can help it, because I don't need that.
Yeah.
But I really want to come back home, honestly, as much as I hate to admit it. I love this area. I'd love to be downtown.
Talk to Dave and Donna.
I did talk to Dave and Donna, from Mineral. And it's Raining Zen. I'm looking, and I think I finally now have to really start pulling together a spreadsheet and calling places.
I put
some stuff out on Facebook and different things like that, but I need to really get going on it.
Yeah, I hope that works out for you.
Because I would love to come back here, especially because if you're like, hey, let's record in Alton, I'm like, you live
I'm
here, you know,
there.
That'd be great. Or hell, it's even halfway to Jacksonville compared to where you are now. Yeah, so if anybody knows anything, please let me know, AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com.
Help
me find an apartment. I don't want to do this.
we really debated on how to handle this episode.
There are some
things we can talk about, but do we have to? I don't know.
I'm not going
to
repeat
it's
a lot of things.
It's just so awful that I just don't know. We wish that, you know, we did a lot of goofing around in our last episode, and we kind of wished we could have taken part of that and put it into this one, but it wouldn't have made sense. But it just, there's just nothing you can say about this episode. There's nothing amusing about it. That's why I changed the opening to the episode. There's just, what do you say about this? I mean, it's just so horrible.
So I did the outline for this. So it's Saturday right now. I did the outline for this on Thursday afternoon. And I've been hanging out at a buddy's house on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We work together.
Then we work out,
that whole thing. He went to get a haircut.
You're never going back to your... Actually, you don't even have an office anymore.
Office is gone.
Well, that's all right.
You know, it turns out a lot of meetings could have been emails. That whole philosophy.
Yeah, absolutely. There is that whole thing.
You don't need a physical space unless you're doing, you know, in-person events.
Sure. Yeah.
So he goes, gets a haircut, comes back. I'm working on this outline. And he looks at me. He's like, are you okay? And I was like, no. And he said, why? No. And I said, all right.
Let me tell you a story.
June 26, 1937, I said these three little girls go missing, ages 7, 8, and 9. They're discovered by Boy Scouts. They've been raped and strangled. And actually, I should reverse that. Strangled and then raped.
Then
right?
raped.
Jesus
yeah.
fucking Christ.
I know, right? Because it can get worse.
Yeah,
it can get worse. I don't know. It's all bad. It doesn't matter what order you put it in. It's awful.
The perps of volunteer policemen who serve as a crossing guard at their elementary school, but it's going to take a long time to get there
and
figure that out.
That's, you know, that's probably one of the most disturbing aspects once you get inside this guy's head, once he starts confessing and you find out that he took this job to be a crossing guard
because
he wants to be around little girls.
Yeah.
I mean, does it get any creepier than that? I don't think it does.
So calculated and everything planned out, which is why it blows my mind that he kind of like freaks out. Like, you know exactly what you're
fucking doing. Oh, he knew. Well, he wanted to. I mean, and I tried to infer that with, you know, that the thought behind this is that he definitely wanted to be caught.
Right.
He had to have wanted to get caught.
Yeah, and that's another thing. We talked about last time, too. Like, if there's any, you know, if there's anybody that, writes to inmates or whatever, but we're talking about psychology and stuff, too. I'm very curious about why do these people want to get caught? I kind of get it, but I kind of don't.
It's guilt. They do the things that they do because they claim that they can't help themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but they want to be punished for what they've done.
Mm.
And, you know, for him to tell, you know, he told the cops that, oh, I loved every minute of it. Well, obviously he didn't, because a psychologist would tell you that the reason that the girls were face down is because he couldn't have them looking at
him.
His face, you know, and that, you know, obviously he wanted to be caught. He was out there putting on a show for everybody, you know, with yelling about stuff and, you know, yelling about string him up, string up the son of a bitch, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, the guy wanted to be caught. I mean, he was daring someone to get him. And eventually when the police I'm not even going to say they were doing bad police work. They were doing what they could for the time period. You know, they were doing everything they could do, and when they didn't catch him fast enough, he just made sure that they caught him by coming in and going, why are you bothering me? I'm innocent.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it took those guys about 3 seconds to realize this guy's not innocent.
Sure.
The only reason he's in here is because he's guilty, so let's just follow him. He's gonna fuck up, which of course he did.
Well,
you know,
I love the way you kind of spelled it all out, too, where it's just like they're following all these leads. This guy already has an alibi. They checked him out, whatever. And then he walks in, and they're kind of like, okay, we can't really fucking deal with you right now.
Yeah, because he's annoying.
But he's a little suspicious, so they let him chill for a second. And then once they start talking to him, then immediately, I just imagine them, like, smoking cigarettes, just being like, you know what, buddy? It's okay. How about you go? You're cool.
Right,
follow this motherfucker.
Uh-huh,
like, then, you know, they finally have a break.
Yeah, so that we can, I mean, we can't prove it by what he's saying right now, but give it 5 minutes and we'll be able to. And by the next day, they're ready to haul him in, you know, because they already knew something was up.
It's so bizarre. And so somebody that does something this messed up, do you know anything about his younger years?
No, not really. If there's information out there, I haven't really found it.
Mm-hmm.
I have only written about this story like the one time, and I had done some research into it and followed the newspaper reports and things, but I don't know what his past history is. There's got to be something there.
Sure.
But I've never run across anything that really explains what his mindset was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, other than he's just creepily fucked up.
Right.
I mean, I think that's a given. But I guess the weird thing about it is, you know, he's been married, you know, he's married to his wife for, you know, and they'd only been married like 2 years. She'd had a couple of miscarriages, so they had lost two babies already. But this guy obviously had a kink somewhere that he had a thing for little girls.
Yeah.
And obsessed about it. I mean, took a job as a crossing guard just to be around little girls.
Right.
And had been warned several times by the school that he was getting too familiar with little girls.
Yeah.
I mean, and this was in the 30s.
Right.
Imagine how with the
you wouldn't
the
be
flags,
warned now.
No, the red flags that would have went up about this creep now.
Yeah.
You know, and that was in the 30s. And, you know, here was a guy hanging around the park as, you know, catching Eddie the Sailor, showing people rope tricks. I mean, what the fuck? That's like a John Wayne Gacy thing.
Gacy
used to, bring these young boys home and go, hey, let me show you how to get out of handcuffs. Right. I mean, are you kidding me with this?
Fuck.
You know, and this is what this guy was doing with rope tricks and stuff. And people just weren't, I mean, it was the 30s, man. You just weren't, I mean... Someone who's writing about historical crimes, you know, that I always tell people, listen, the good old days were never good.
Sure.
These people have been among us. These monsters have been among us since the beginning of recorded time. It's just that now we pay attention to them. And but in the 30s, I mean, there were just as many pedophiles and perverts and freaks and deviants as there are now.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that they didn't have a platform the way that they do today.
That's what my friend actually asked me. He's a lawyer, and he said, when did this happen? And I said, 37. And he goes, people have been fucked up for that long?
Yes.
And I said
much longer.
I was like, you have no idea.
You have no idea.
And he's a lawyer. He sees the worst people all the time.
Right.
Says,
and
they didn't have...
see them now, and we see them on a regular basis because people know what to watch for. But in the 1930s, you know, Joe Public had no idea to look for this stuff.
You don't want to believe it.
School officials told this guy to stop being, you know, pals with little girls, but they probably weren't thinking, well, he's going to rape and kill little girls.
Yeah.
They just think he's being creepy, you know. But this guy went beyond creepy, you know, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, he decided that the only way that he could have sex with little girls is if he killed them first, because that way they couldn't resist.
Right.
I mean, you are completely beyond redemption at that point.
Sure.
There's just nothing, there's no way that you're, and that's, that mindset will never change. There's no reform for somebody like that. Don't at me at this, because I'm telling you, I don't care what you tell me, I'm never going to be convinced that someone like this can be reformed. You cannot.
Well, he's not insane. He knew what
he
was doing.
No, he knew exactly what he was doing.
He was calculated.
He is,
so I agree.
He's a monster. He is, period. That kind of person is a monster. There's nothing you could ever tell me would convince me otherwise that someone like this can be changed or redeemed. This is the kind of person that, in my opinion, I'm not saying you should kill them, although it might cross my mind, but these people, anybody who like this guy should be locked away from the rest of humanity and kept separate from the rest of us, because there's no way to cure this. I'm sorry if this offends anyone with my statements. I'm not some kind of weird right wing, you know, kill everybody, you know, kind of thing, but someone like this is unredeemable as far as I'm concerned.
Well, yeah, hey, if someone has a stance
you're not
going to
change his
against
mind.
This opinion, I'd be very interested to hear how you're
I really don't want to hear from you. If you're against that opinion, I really don't need to hear from you, you've got something wrong with you too.
I like them to out themselves publicly.
Okay, I can see what you're saying.
So you talk about police finally called psychiatrist Dr. Joseph Paul DeRiver.
And listen, this guy,
he's going to
sounds
come back
like
later.
A hero in this episode, but
sure.
He'll be back.
Right.
He's going to be back in another season of the podcast. And this guy's a quack, as it turns out.
I thought he was going to be a good...
Well, he is in the beginning, but he will prove himself to be a quack later on. But
well, what the heck?
Well, he's a psychiatrist. You know those people are crazier than the rest of us. I mean, that's why they do what they do.
I guess so.
So I will apologize in advance to anyone who is a psychiatrist or psychologist out there, but you've probably got some screws loose, because I don't find very many of you that are that sane. I should really shut up a little shouldn't I?
It's funny because my undergrad was psychology. And so like the smart people would always be like, oh, so what's wrong with you? Because it's like you're trying to fix yourself.
Exactly,
I'm like, hey, you know what? You're right.
At least I know what's wrong.
Yeah, at least I know there's. Yeah, at least I know there's something wrong with me. Jeez. Okay. Well, let's. I want to dive into this just a little bit more about.
Sure. Yeah.
I'm very curious about how this all goes down. So July 2nd, if a ton of suspects with tattoos that kind of match description, things like that. A lot of them have alibis.
Yeah, I mean, and tattoos were not common in the 30s.
Yeah, I guess I didn't think about that.
Yeah, right. I mean, the only people that had tattoos back then usually were sailors.
Sure.
I mean, that's this is the 1930s, 1940s. This is the Sailor Jerry type Navy tattoos. I mean, most people did not have tattoos back then.
Yeah.
So that made him an uncommon, you know, suspect. You know, the fact that he had tattoos.
Why would you show that?
I know, too, but you saw more of that in like Los Angeles.
Well, sure,
and because there's naval ships, there's a lot of ships coming in that are not part of the military. You've got a lot of merchant marines, you've got a lot of people who are just, you know, shipping out on, you know, but that was the common way of transporting goods at the time.
Sure.
So you had, you know, Long Beach and San Pedro and that whole area down there. So you had a lot of people with tattoos. So broadcasting that your suspect had a tattoo in Southern California at the time didn't narrow it down as much as it would have, say,
anywhere
in
else.
Chicago or St. Louis or anywhere else. You're right.
Right.
But it was still fairly uncommon, you know, at the time.
Yeah. Well, hell, it's like, okay, if you've one of those identifying marks, you know, maybe, maybe cover it up.
Yeah. Today, if you said, oh, he's got a tattoo, well, that's not going to narrow it down.
Right.
But
right.
Then it did.
So they tail him, obviously, as soon as he leaves. Eventually, they take him to the crime scene to see how he behaves. He starts trembling, crying, freaking out. So this...
That was something the cops used to do a lot.
Oh, yeah.
I found, digging up through historical crimes, that was something that they would often do to try to break down a suspect. Because back then, when there was no Miranda warnings, there was nothing that
said you
could just beat the shit out of somebody to get a confession out of them. Right. The rubber hose thing,
right.
You know. And you could grill them for 4 days straight without sleep. And, you know, there were no rules about that kind of stuff. So they would drag these guys out to the crime scene just to see what they would do.
Sure.
And some of them, like this dupe, would just break down and fall apart. And some of them would get off on it. You know? But all of those things were assigned to these, you know, especially these veteran detectives, you know, and every time I think of cops in the 30s and 40s in LA, I always, you know, picture these guys from old black and white movies,
yeah.
You know, because they're the badasses with the hats and the trench coats and the cigarettes.
they were out of
a crime noir book or a movie.
Yeah.
And they, you know, weren't opposed to putting the bright light in your face and grilling you and rolling up a phone book and whacking you with it and stuff. And, you know, that's what I picture. And that's what I picture with a lot of these guys.
Yeah.
And I know that I tend to, you know, glamorize that whole, in a lot
you
of
do.
My writings, I glamorize those guys, but they were just as dirty as a lot of other cops
of course.
Were. I mean, you know, LA was, you know, the LAPD was so corrupt in the 1930s and 40s, but you know, usually that corruption had to do with mob guys and stuff.
Well,
had nothing to do with, you know, perverts and child murderers because these guys had no tolerance for that kind of thing. Even the inmates didn't. I mean, that was the whole point.
This guy was
afraid that everybody in Englewood was going to kill him. And then when they took him to jail, if anybody could have got their hands on him, and that's something that holds up till today.
Right.
I mean, guys will tell you that have done any kind of time. They'll tell you that child murderers.
It's so weird too.
It's like a code of honor. Well,
thing.
It's the difference is that these guys, while they might have committed murder or sold drugs or whatever they did to end up in prison, 99% of them have kids. You know, and it may be by multiple people and multiple kids, but they all have kids, and they don't tolerate kitty diddlers in prison. I mean, that's just a thing they don't do.
Sure.
Inmates, I mean, those guys usually have to be kept separate from the general population because they will kill you. So that's been a thing forever. And obviously it was going on in the 30s and probably before that.
Right. Well, this is what baffles me. So you said they take him to the crime scene and he starts trembling, crying, and like freaking out. So they arrest him. So that really makes me even more curious about like what had he done before this. Like, I can't imagine he had done nothing or never acted on any urges and then he just broke and it freaked.
I'm not sure that you're correct on that. I think this might have been, you know,
you think this was his
nine
first
times
offense?
Out of 10. It's his first murder.
Sure.
Now, whether it was his first offense, whether or not he hasn't been, or I'm going to say there's a really good chance that this built up where there were other things involved.
But
we
don't know. Murder,
we know so little about his background. Mm-hmm. We really don't know that much. But I would say there are probably, this is a guess. Now, this is just kind of based on, you know, working on this kind of stuff for years. I would say based on what happened that he built up to this, that there was some... probably some kids that were molested in the past, even dating back to when he was a kid, like 13, 14 years
old,
with a younger kid. I'm going to say he's maybe not ever raped a child, but probably molested some because this is like a buildup thing. This is where you explode. And he, you know, took this job as a crossing guard so he could be around little girls. And then this is not something that all of the sudden that you've done nothing else ever. I'm going to say never probably committed a murder, and he probably never raped a child.
Right.
But the fact that
he murdered three girls and
raped all three of them tells me that this was something that he built up to.
Yeah.
This was the explosion of what it was that was in his brain. And then he just completely fell apart.
So he had deteriorated
so rapidly after doing it that he knew that at this point he would never do anything like this again.
Yeah.
I don't think he would have. But he wanted to be caught to make sure that he never did anything like this again.
Yeah, I guess when you put it that way, it probably makes sense. He almost went like immediately into his like berserker mode sort of thing. Right.
I mean, this is like when you look at a serial killer who starts out as, you know, killing and mutilating animals, and then he might hurt another child. Maybe he doesn't kill them, but he hurts one, and then eventually he commits his first murder. And then the space between the murders gets shorter and shorter as time goes on until finally, in a kind of a mad kind of spree,
well, the berserker
several of
mode,
them together,
call,
and
yeah.
then they get caught.
Right. It was like Ted Bundy when he escapes from prison, goes down to Florida.
Yes, of course he goes bananas after that and kills as many as he can because he knows he's going to get caught again at some point.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is
just
what
this
he
guy
does.
Right out of the gate.
I mean, yeah, 9 times out of 10, those kind of sprees don't go on for years and years. There are rare exceptions.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I mean, BTK went on for a long time. I mean, Bundy did technically, but, you know, he was caught, he was in jail, he got back out, committed more murders. But a lot of these, you know, these murder cases, that's why, you know, we did an entire season on the Villisca murders, which I say Villisca murders, and what I really mean by that is that spree
of murders.
And, you know, several of them happen very close together, and then that was it.
Yeah.
No more. Because he didn't get caught, but somewhere he got tripped up.
Right.
And, you know, ended up in prison or dead or in an insane asylum or something because he finally lost his shit after Villisca. You know, so I think that that's a pretty common thing when it comes to that kind of stuff. And I think that this guy, you know, this was a case worth talking about because it's not well known and because he swore that these girls were haunting him in his jail cell. I mean, this was in the newspapers.
Yeah.
I mean, he really swore this was the truth. And I can't say one way or the other. I mean, it could have certainly been a product of his own, you know, messed up head. But, you know, I think that this guy had to be caught because I don't think he would have done this again.
Yeah.
Because this was the culmination of all of his, you know, fucked up at this.
Sure.
That's a word.
No,
it's not a word, but you know what I mean.
No, I get it. Yeah, and I think when those guys do that kind of shit and go in their like berserker mode stuff and just go one after another, I feel like they are just as surprised as everybody else.
Probably.
That they haven't been getting caught.
Right, that they haven't gotten caught.
Yeah,
so
just keep going.
So catch me. You know, here I'm going to do this, so catch me.
Right, and so I do... Is it weird to say I love that he was haunted by these?
I do
girls,
too.
You know?
I do too. And I point that out a couple times. I feel like he got what he deserved. If these ghosts and whether he just believed they were there or they were really there, he deserved it. And that's why in the final line, I say, you know, they hung him, but it's too bad they couldn't have hung him two more times for all three girls, because this is a horrible story.
I haven't listened to this monologue yet, but I did put that at the end of this, that I loved your final two lines for this.
That's exactly how I feel about it. And I wish that they could have killed him three times over.
Yeah, well, he made sure to pray for forgiveness for what he had done. He wanted to get caught in a weird way, like a lot of killers do. We've kind of talked about that a little bit. But
there's no God that would forgive this. I don't care what you believe. You know, I say that maybe God did. I don't believe it. There is a God, I don't believe there's a God that would forgive this.
I don't want to hang out with him if he forgives this shit.
I can't see it. So
yes, no, I totally agree. Your jury only deliberated for 2 days. I'm surprised it took them that long, but maybe
some things to go to deal with there.
Yes, yeah. And on his way out, he told his wife, "Well, I guess I'll see you in heaven." Again,
how would you like to be her? That's the thing.
Well, she okay. Why did she lie for him then?
Well, because I think that at that point she couldn't believe that he would have done it.
Uh huh.
I think that he probably obviously she was naive.
Yeah.
And probably believed when he told her that, hey, listen, I'm being accused of this, and I didn't do anything wrong. They're just saying that because, you know, I've been trying to help, and it, you know, it makes me look bad or something, you know. I mean, there's a million excuses, and, you know, it's worked on so many spouses over the years.
Well, you don't want to believe
with
it.
These kinds of cases.
Yeah,
you don't want to believe it because they're a young couple. They've only been married for 2 years and had a seemingly normal life. Well, obviously, he had an inner life that she knew nothing about. Although, I mean...
Well, she just probably ignored the signs.
Yeah, but because wouldn't you have wondered, this guy's keeping a scrapbook.
That's what
of
like
these
cuts,
and
even,
she's helping him.
That's
keep
what
it.
Cuts even more deep. It's like, yeah, helps her make, or she helps
but
him make
you know
the scrapbook.
Though? But here's a guy who's been involved in every single aspect of this investigation, from the volunteering for the search to going down to the police station and, you know, shaking the hands of all the
every
cops
cop.
Involved, and thanking them for their help. And maybe she just wants to believe that he just is so concerned.
Sure.
Because he wants to be a family man.
Right.
You know, and so he's so worried he doesn't want something like that to happen to his kids someday.
Right.
I mean, there's a million things that you could say about this.
The lady doth protest too much kind
of thing. Well, and I think but I also think that people like this guy's obviously... You know, yes, he's never done anything like this before, but he's had to have been thinking about it his entire life.
Of course.
So, which makes him very manipulative. Mm-hmm. And so he has found people like this seek out people they can manipulate and people that they can put under their control. And remember, this is the 1930s. Things were different then.
Sure.
And, you know, she was a housewife and she stayed at home. And I'm sure that there were ways that he manipulated her into believing that, you know, if the police come around asking questions, well, you know, they're just doing their job. They have to. They're asking about everybody.
Right.
And so she's willing to lie for him, but only for so long.
Sure.
But on the other hand, she keeps coming to court. You know, and I don't, you know, what do you think?
I don't know.
What
the
do
human condition is conflicting.
Yeah, I guess
you know?
It is. People are strange. You know, it's just, we can't know what's in other people's heads. And
terrifying.
I feel bad for her.
Of course.
I do. I feel bad for her. But on the other hand, what are you thinking?
I still feel bad for her. You want to wish the best and people and
not for him but
no well
for
not
her.
For him sure
definitely
but
for
I
her.
Would be curious like this is getting really really deep into it but like did they have a normal sex life
well apparently
you know like
I mean that's everything that I've ever found has made a notation a seemingly normal sex life
right
I mean
which,
they've
which,
had
whatever but
she's
sure,
had
okay.
two miscarriages so I mean obviously they were having sex but I just don't know
what are the red flags
there have somewhere, to be, right? You would think.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, he kept putting this rope around my neck.
Well,
I didn't ask him to.
And I'm not even sure it's that. I'm not even strangling thing. It's the little girl thing.
Yes,
I mean, that's fucked up. I mean, the strangling thing, at least you can look at it as a kink. And if people are into it, consenting adults, whatever. But
I'm down.
Kids, there's no excuse for that. You know,
God.
I don't know, man. It's, I don't listen to Awful Story. And there's not...
I don't like it.
There's no way to dig out from this one. There just isn't. All you can do is look at it. We can talk about it.
Yep.
We can pick it apart. We can answer questions that we think that people might have, but...
We can ask questions, too, right, if there are professionals that listen or
something. Right, but there's no way to...
We're not going to feel better.
There's no good spin to put on this. No, I mean,
I haven't made hardly any jokes.
No, well, there isn't. There's nothing to be made. You know, at least, you know, we looked at, like, say our last episode, we've got this guy who's taking pictures of girls out in the desert and murdering them. But on the other hand, we've got this girl who beats the shit out of him.
Right, bites him.
It's got a great spin to it. Yeah. Everybody got caught in our last episode. And yes, this guy gets caught, but at the cost of three little girls.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just... I mean, little girls. These are not...
Seven, eight, nine.
Yeah, this is not... It's not good.
No.
You know, it's just... I mean, this is awful. And the next episode is awful, too.
Damn
and then
it, Troy. And
I'll try to get us
about,
into
yet.
Something a little funkier after that. But this next episode is just as awful.
Yeah.
And, yeah, cool. It just is. So, but, you know, while there aren't many happy endings in our Hollywood episodes,
sure.
At least we can get onto something a little different. But we've got to get through one more
all
awful
right.
one.
Well,
I apologize, but it's going to happen.
We'll get through it.
Just so you know, it's going to happen.
Well, this man's finally hanged on September 16th, 1938, which is sort of...
Interesting that we've had the first the last
yes.
people in our last two episodes that were hanged before they started using the gas chamber.
How would you want to go if you had to choose, you think?
If I had to choose hanged? I'm going to go way against hanged.
Well, yeah.
That would be awful.
With the firing squad.
Yeah, I don't know, man, because... I've seen too many times in all the things I've done over the years of guys getting shot five and six times and not dying. So, I mean, there's no guarantee with the firing squad because they're just going to keep shooting you.
Don't they only have certain people that actually have real bullets, though, so people don't know who's actually killing
people? Yeah, but
that's
not a good thing. So it's one bullet. What if just one bullet hits you and you're still alive?
I didn't know how much you knew about this. So I'm curious to pick your brain.
Well, I think that I don't know if that's accurate. Or
I don't.
Not.
I don't know. I've heard that.
I can't imagine
that
it is, but
probably not.
Maybe not everyone has live bullets. I really don't know on that.
If you're a person who's moved up enough in the ranks to kill somebody, wouldn't you? Can you tell the difference between firing a live round versus a blank?
That's a good question.
You know,
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know that there's a good way.
No, hell no.
I mean, I don't know lethal injections. They say you just go to sleep. But then I've also heard that it's like
extremely
horrific pain before you do.
Right.
I don't know. I'm going to pass. I mean, after watching The Green Mile, I know I wouldn't want to go in the electric chair.
You got to wet that sponge.
Especially if you're, you got Percy running the thing for you.
Yeah.
You're Edward Delacroix. I don't think you don't want to be him,
no.
Or John Coffey for that matter. So I'm not really sure that there is a good way.
Sure.
Old age? Is that a
in your sleep?
Yeah. I don't even know about that.
What do you mean? I don't know
what would be better.
Would you be walking with a cane and
sleep?
Just falling over?
I mean, I guess it would be peaceful, but
well, then what did you mean by old age?
Well, I don't know.
Drop dead during a game of shuffleboard?
I
like,
guess,
what are you talking
but
about?
I don't know. I think I'd rather know. I mean, if you go to sleep, you're just going to go to sleep one night and not wake up. And it seems like, I mean, I guess that's
a
bonus
a
to
forever.
Some people. To me, that seems like, but
you want to know you're dying?
I had something left to do.
You think you want to know
I don't know.
You're
I'm always going to have something left to do. So I don't.
Unfinished business.
Yeah, I'm going to have a book that I didn't finish. So that's my plan is to
be
never
a ghostwriter.
I want to be a ghost. I mean, I want to come back and haunt people. So maybe if I just always have a book half done, I will have to stay behind.
What if you are okay, so this is a TV show idea, I'm sure it's been done, but you're the ghostwriter who writes through someone to finish your book
awesome.
And that's your unfinished
that's,
business.
That's Pearl Curran. That was our St. Louis episode. I could write through a
Dude,
Ouija
that
board,
is
right?
one of the episodes so. I tell people all the time to listen to that. I'm like, apologize for the audio, but that is still
yeah,
that probably
great.
The
oh,
most
that was
messed
probably
up
a little
story.
Better one than I think we were
well,
getting
yeah, yeah.
further along.
We were getting
audio
better,
wasn't
but
as bad.
That is still the one story where people are like, okay, well, they're like, oh, you don't believe in
Convince
ghosts or
me.
Whatever. and I'm like, here's the one that I'm like, I got nothing. Yeah. That's a crazy story.
Nothing.
Yeah, Pearl. I think it's
her birthday was just this past week. So I just posted about that,
and I didn't celebrate. Yeah. No, I think it's what is it? Season two. I think it's might just be called the Curious Case of Pearl Curran or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go check it out.
Patience Worth or Pearl Curran, one or the other.
And I made it. I think the first time I ever made a joke that made you laugh. I said I would have taken her on the road, and I would have had a show called Testing My Patience.
Yeah.
And you actually like that one.
Yeah.
Oh man.
So yeah, I don't know. I don't have
You don't know how you want to die? Okay.
I don't have a good one. I just well, I mean, I don't want to. That's well, the thing. I don't want to
you're
die.
You're probably so stubborn enough you fucking won't,
you know. So I don't know.
You'll outlive us all.
I have no idea.
Oh,
well, you know, my thing was I want to live to be 114. I don't know how I came up with that number.
Yeah.
But I just saw like a nun. Did you see that the other day?
Yeah.
There was a nun who just survived COVID. She's 117.
She's like the second oldest person.
And she survived like the Spanish influenza and, you know, and COVID. And she's 117 years old. And I thought, yeah, but if you've got to be like a nun or a monk or something, that's not going to work for me.
No, hell no.
But, you know... I mean, I thought, wow, she's only 3 years older than my goal.
You don't know where the 114 came from?
I don't know where it came from. I just picked it out of the blue before, and I just decided that's my goal. Never going to make it, but, you know, it's there.
Well, it's nice to have goals. Yeah. You were also talking earlier about being cold and all that sort of stuff.
It doesn't really bother me.
Well, it made me wonder, when was the last time you didn't have facial hair or didn't have a beard like you have now?
Well, I've had scruff for a really long time. Yeah. And in the 90s, I had a goatee.
I've seen pictures.
Yeah, scary.
Of the real Troy Taylor.
I've had scruff for a while, but I think I've had like an actual beard for probably the last 5 years or so.
So it's like, I feel like you just don't get cold because that's the only place I get cold now is my
really?
Face.
Yeah,
I don't have a
maybe beard. Maybe that's the secret. I don't know what it is, but no, I just don't really get cold. So... I mean, I'm about to die in this room. I don't know how hot it is in here, but I feel great, but I run cold. And, you know, at least it would be cold in here right now.
Yeah.
But, so I'm just always warm. And so I just have always just dressed in layers. And so buying this coat was a real step for me. And it's probably as soon as the temperature gets up like to 30, it'll probably get like mothballed until next year or something. But
real kick in the beard.
But it was worth it, you know.
It's a nice looking coat.
Yeah, it's a nice coat, I guess. But
all right. Well,
who needs a parka?
It is now time
to live in Alaska.
It's now time for our Ghost Rider segment. If you have a question or comment about the world of macabre, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. This first email is titled Spanish Horror Movies, which I think you will like.
Which I love.
I know
as you
do.
Know. So.
This is from Gonzalo, and it says, "Hi guys, I finished listening to our favorite 2020 horror movies podcast. I've seen many of the movies."
Several of them on that list.
Right. "I've seen many of the movies you mentioned and already watched some because of your recommendations. For instance, Underwater and what was it? Malasana 32?
Yeah, 32 Malasana Street. Yeah.
Yeah, that one.
Love that movie.
At one point, you mentioned a Spanish horror movies. To my surprise, you mentioned one of my all-time favorite horror movies, The Orphanage.
Oh, yeah. You cannot go wrong with that movie.
You went on the name of a few other Spanish ones, but the one you did not mention and I highly recommend is Veronica.
Oh, yeah. That's good, too. Okay. I like that. Yeah, that's a good one.
So, yeah.
That's a good one. That was on. It's
link.
On Netflix.
Okay.
If anybody wants to watch it, it's a Ouija board story about a demon. That's a good one.
Yeah. Oh, you said
Based
the Netflix.
On a true story. Yeah.
That's
a great movie. Yeah. Well, it was, I don't think it's been, I think it came out before we started doing our year-end lists.
Gotcha.
And I think that's why. But yeah, I love that one.
Okay.
It's great.
No, it's good to know. It said, side note, completely unrelated to horror or movies. The movie features good music from a Spanish rock artist named Bunbury, I believe. The main character in the movie has posters in her bedroom where shirts of the artist is playing their music
on
a Walkman. A Walkman, very nostalgic, said. Anyway, back to horror movies. Since you mentioned liking for Spanish horror movies, I am almost positive you would enjoy Veronica. Thanks.
Yeah, love that movie.
That's awesome. Yeah, thanks for the suggestion. I'll have to check that out. This is the last one we have right here. So it says, "The Limps brought me the podcast. The podcast brought me back for more." This is from Christina. Said, "A lot late to the game, but you know the saying, better late than never. I have been binge listening since last month and I'm currently on season 4, episode 4. What is this?
Bunbury.
Okay.
I can only play a few seconds, so we're on a podcast. But
fair enough. Well, that's true. I don't want to get any
this
copyright.
This is like their French. Top. Hey, I'm going to check that out.
You like that?
Yeah, I love Spanish stuff. That's going to be great. So
all right.
Thank you for sending that in. Seriously.
I was introduced to the podcast because of the Limp family, as we were talking about, and wanted to learn more about the family in a Facebook group, and someone sent us the podcast. Oh, that's great.
Oh, awesome.
I would have written a review, but I have an Android and can't log into iTunes to do that.
Yeah, I know.
Shit happens. I get it.
I know.
Anyway, I want to say I'd appreciate the history and the banter. I know that in a previous comment, someone said that they don't like the banter, but
we don't care.
But I feel it gives the podcast character, she says. Yeah.
There you go.
The introduction that Troy gives
us. He gets it.
Introduction that Troy gives is phenomenal, but the banter makes the show. Thanks for the podcast helped me get through the past month and a half of the pandemic, and we are also going to the event scheduled on February 20th, so I'm pretty excited.
Oh, awesome.
That's great. Awesome.
Yeah. Which has already happened by the time this episode airs.
Yes.
yeah. Obviously we're recording it before everybody knows how this works.
So if you meet a Christina, I hope that you have a good time. Said, P.S. Cody, I'm from Wisconsin. What's up with what is this giving up alcohol for a month or a period of time?
That's the dumbest thing. I know. Yeah, he always does this every year. You didn't do it this year, did you?
I did.
Oh, in January?
Yep.
Did you?
I like to be in complete.
Oh, you know, I don't think we.
Complete control of my addiction.
We didn't get together in January. You had COVID. Yep. Well, fuck, I guess you probably did give up alcohol.
That made it really easy.
You couldn't taste it.
That made it Well, that's the thing. I think it actually. Okay.
I didn't even think about that.
I actually lied now. One of the things I did do when I had COVID to see if I could taste, I took a shot.
Oh, okay.
And I couldn't taste.
Yeah.
Anything.
So that worked out well this year. I forgot that you always did that.
I do, and I'll do it again in September.
I'm Irish. We don't give up alcohol.
Hey, I have to show.
Unless we have to. A 12-step program.
Exactly. I have to show that I'm in control of my demons twice a year. Thanks for writing in AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. We appreciate all the notes and questions and comments. It's great.
Yeah, and thank you for the suggestion.
Well,
and Veronica, which I had seen, I'm really glad. Maybe that'll introduce it to other people.
Yeah,
because that is a good movie. In fact, I rewatched it during the pandemic.
Yeah.
I ran across it again, and I thought I haven't seen this for a while. And decided to watch it again. But I'm also going to check out this artist because what little I heard, I already liked.
Right.
So I'm already jazzed about it.
There you go.
That's great.
We also have a couple new subscribers on Patreon. So I want to give shout outs to Holly, Janine, April, Taylor, Glenn, James, Jenny, and Betty. Thank you very much for subscribing to the show.
Thank you very much.
Sound a lot better. You want to take us out?
Yeah. Yeah. Guys, thank you very much. I know this was a grim episode, and I know I have been promising you another grim episode next time. But I was going to say it'll get better after that, but let's be honest, it's not going to.
It's
but
not.
At least it won't be. I think this is our last murdered kids episode. Our next one will be the last murdered children episode, get into murdered adults, I guess.
Well,
but
that, why is that
at least
somehow
it's,
better?
Well, I don't know if it's better.
It makes
it's
me
just,
feel better, though.
Yeah, you don't feel as bad because you
they
figure...
They lived a life?
Right. Well, or you figure that it's an adult, they probably did something that, you know, that they deserved it. not necessarily, but you know what I mean.
I totally get it. And I hate kids. One of my favorite Instagram accounts is kids getting hurt. I don't give a fuck about
great.
Kids. I'll watch them fall down.
I know, but this made me so sad. And
so
for our live episode that everybody probably listened to a couple weeks ago that we did at Dead of Winter was a lot of dead kids.
It
and
made
that
me
bothered
so
Cody
sad.
Too.
It made me so sad.
And
I
it is
think
a sad story.
Sad.
It's just one that I've known that story for so long that I thought, well, this would be a great episode to do for a winter theme, not thinking how depressing it was for everybody.
It was your writing and the description, like the way you put together the words was beautiful and so upsetting.
Well, thanks.
So
upsetting. Thank you. But we will steer clear after next week of dead kids. I don't think
no promises
probably anymore this season that
okay.
I can think of.
He's
anyway.
Lying.
Well, no, I don't think I am.
Well, I don't think you're intentionally lying, but I don't.
There will
make
be
any...
more eventually, but not in this particular season.
This
probably.
Is like you're the weatherman saying 100% chance.
Well,
of
yeah,
no
you're
more
right.
Dead
or 0% chance
right.
of snow. There'll be 0% chance of dead kids in this season, and then you know that's. Not a call you should make.
Exactly.
Anyway, guys, thank you for listening. And we hope that you will continue to listen, continue to let other people know about the podcast. I mean, if you like it, please spread it around. If you don't like it, just don't tell anybody.
Yeah. Just don't say anything.
Stop listening.
Just
you know,
keep your
if
mouth
you don't
shut.
Like it, don't listen. But if you do like it, spread it around to your friends, and we will see you in a couple of weeks.
Okay, so this super depressing episode of American Hauntings Podcast was written by Troy Taylor for some damn reason.
Yeah.
And it was produced and edited by me in tears, Cody Beck. If you're not a regular listener of the podcast, we hope you'll check out our biweekly dose of history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of
American
history.
If you're not a regular
listener
and you just drop into one of these episodes,
imagine if this is someone's jumping on.
That's what I was thinking too. You're really going to go, okay, these guys, I don't want to listen to this.
This is so depressing. Yeah. You can find and subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere you listen to your favorite shows, or you just not listen if this is your first episode. Just be like, I'm done, never listen again.
Yeah.
You can find our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com.
Did you ever start putting up the photos that we talked about?
We'll talk about that later.
Shows, notes, photos, links, more.
So no photos.
I should just take that out. Is that what you're saying?
You know, we'll talk about it later. If you're a regular listener,
you know, I only write every one of these, right? And record the monologues. You could at least put pictures up.
On the Apple Podcast app and share the show with your friends, neighbors, relatives, people you pass in the street. Should it be whomever or is it whoever?
I don't know. I know it probably should be whomever, but that sounds pretentious.
It does sound pretentious.
I don't really like to use whom because it sounds pretentious.
It's a made-up word to
really
trick
like
students.
I actually said in one of these episodes, I actually caught myself and it was too late to stop. I actually said during one of the monologues, I actually said advertisement.
Oh my gosh.
It was
gosh.
In the last episode.
While you were sipping tea?
I said advertisement and I thought... and I just left it. And I should have taken it out. I guess if I start saying schedule and things like that,
schedule.
You're going to stop me from talking about, you
actually,
know, eating chips and, you know, and crisps and things.
Biscuits.
But I really did say advertisement and I caught myself doing it and I left it. So it's in the episode.
Sometimes you'll say a word and then in the middle of it, you will like stutter or say like or something, and like I don't think you realize how much I make you say things you didn't actually say, or I make it sound so I have so many hours of your voice I could make you say whatever the hell
I'm sure
want
you
at
could
this point.
Yeah
I'm so sure if anybody has any ideas
yeah and I always I found that always guy. As I'm reading this stuff out loud, and I'm not sure I do it when I'm just reading it, but when I'm reading stuff out loud I find myself saying neither all the time. In the podcasts I say neither, but I think when I'm just like talking just in general or in my head when I'm reading, I think I just say neither. But I know that I say neither in these monologues, and I don't necessarily mean to. I'm not trying to sound like an asshole, but I do it. And I mean, really, I think the highest level of my assholishness was advertisement. And I left it in there and I should have taken it out, and someone will probably make fun of me about it, but whatever.
I'm gonna turn that part up.
You know, I'm an Anglophile. I can't help it. So. You know.
Oh geez. Okay. If you're a fan, then you also know that American Hauntings is not just this podcast. It's books, tours, events, and our main website is AmericanHauntings.net. For those of you who write to us and tell us that you wish we posted shows more often, well, you can have fresh content.
This is my
snarky
way of telling people, hey, man, Patreon.
Patreon.
Really,
that's not the only perk you'll get either. It helps us out. There's discounts, shirts, stuff in the mail, all kinds of things. For those who don't understand how important our Patreon is,
I mean, because if you haven't looked at Cody's shirt, I mean, people don't always know this. People don't understand that the American Hauntings clothing thing is yours.
Oh, yeah.
And that's something that we just kind of do, Cody does in conjunction with American Hauntings.
Yep.
And he puts up new shirts all the time. And
just
I don't
get a wild
think,
hair and just kind of
yeah,
put it up.
I don't think people realize just how many. I mean, the only time they use the messaging thing when they think it's going to get to me. And that,
I know.
Those don't go to me. Stop sending messages
you know, who
that
would
way.
Know that, though?
But the clothing thing is Cody's. And there's some. I mean, I do shirts every once in a while, like as a special edition thing, but not very often, or like the hats or something. But Cody does. There's a lot of really fun shirts on there, like our Morbidly Curious shirt and stuff. There are some good shirts on there. If you are a Patreon subscriber and that's the level that you're at, you get to pick from those shirts.
You get six shirts
and
a year?
Seriously, it's worth it because there's some really fun shirts on
there.
Well,
thanks.
Really, I mean, there's some, people show them to me all the time, and I guess they think that I came up with it. I'm like, That's Cody. That's all me, and that's awesome. But that's Cody's thing. So
well,
yeah,
yeah. I just have
anyway,
like,
I just wanted to mention that because I don't think everybody realizes.
Well, I appreciate it. Yeah, I just,
yeah.
Like,
there's fun stuff.
I have
on there.
A lot of ideas like on a whiteboard stuff, but I have shirts to say like haunted. You
yeah,
know,
but there's
ghosted,
there's one about like this.
There's some
house
horrors
is,
in this house.
Yeah, that's it. There's some horrors in this house. It's hilarious. I mean, and I think that came out of our New Orleans season, didn't it?
It did.
I
but
thought.
Then, well, then that
it
song came out. And
yeah,
this,
yeah, yeah.
Kind of like put it all together.
Yeah, some fun stuff. Yeah. So anyway, sorry.
No, you're fine.
Go ahead with your thing.
This is the nicest thing Troy's ever said to me.
Oh, it is not.
So thank you for – yeah, check out the Patreon.
In public, probably. You're right. So.
If you have any comments about the show, suggestions,
did
reviews,
we say patreon.com/AmericanHauntings? I don't know if you said that.
I did not say patreon.com.
Yeah, you can find it on our page and stuff. And seriously, it's – you know, I mean, you could go as low as a dollar.
Yeah.
If you're – you know, want to do that, or
that's
you
really
can
nice
go up.
Though.
It is. We appreciate it. But seriously, the shirt thing is what is what gets me. Oh no, seriously, because there's a lot of fun stuff in that store.
Yeah,
it's a separate store from the rest of our store,
yeah.
And it's got a lot of fun stuff in it.
We have masks and sweatshirts.
Yeah, there's all kinds
and
of stuff.
We have also.
I mean, there are all kinds of hoodies. We do a couple. We did a couple for special events. Cody's got them all the time.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and there's a ton of t-shirts and stuff. And honestly. I recommend it. Even if you don't want to join Patreon, I'm just telling you how
sure.
you can get 6 free, you know, with your Patreon yeah. membership a year. But just if you just want to check it out, seriously, there's
well,
fun
thanks.
Stuff in there. So I recommend it.
That's awesome. And also there is a Patreon tier that I don't know if anybody's ever hit.
What's that?
Where it's talking to you, I think. They get some like one-on-one conversation
really?
With you.
Okay, well, I didn't approve
I
that.
Lisa
I don't
I
know.
Did,
I don't know who
so
did that.
Anybody wants
but...
to check that out, patreon.com/AmericanHaunting.
Well,
and if you have any
I mean,
comments
I guess
about
I'll have to go
show,
along with it, but I did not approve that in advance.
It'd be so,
so
funny.
You know.
Comments about the show, suggestions,
you gotta be like
jokes.
Doing like cameo things or something?
You actually do the singing telegram.
Oh, no, there's no way. Yeah. No one wants that.
It's a $10,000 Patreon.
Oh, yeah, right.
Just tell us what you really think of us. We're reachable via email on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Messages in a Bottle, Carrier Pigeon.
And Telegram.
And Telegram.
Thank you, Diana, again.
Thank you so much, Diana. Yeah. Until next time.
Goodbye, so long.
See you later.
See you later.
All right, that was just over an hour, too.
That turned out to be, we made it work.
Yeah, we made it work.
Yeah, we made it work. I was... I'm